Session 5. Communicating with your children. Children often measure parental love for them by the quality and quantity of the time shared. Learn vital communication tools for listening for meaning and providing feedback to increase your quality time with your child.
You know, Brian, we've been talking throughout this program about communicating with your children, and I believe that communicating is the linking element throughout parenting. I think the real key here is how to talk so that kids will listen and how to listen so that kids will talk. And in this session, we're going to be talking about how to listen to children so that they will be talking to you and how to talk to them in a way that really wins their respect and cooperation.
Well, I think one of the most important things about communicating is the fact that you communicate with your children the way you communicate with yourself. The quality of your intrapersonal communication, your inner dialogue, is going to dramatically affect how easily and well you communicate with your children. So you start with yourself and realize that sometimes you have a lot of noise going on in your own mind, interference, distraction, fatigue, anger, worry, frustration. And if you're not aware of that, your ability to communicate effectively with your children is going to be directly impaired.
I agree, and I think that's how communication keeps linking back to self-esteem, Brian, that the picture we have of ourselves and our own sense of self-esteem really shows up in our style of communicating with our children. And in helping children raise their sense of self-esteem, communicating clearly and to always keep in mind that what we're doing is modeling a style of communicating, because not only communicating gets their cooperation, but also teaches them a lot about how they will communicate later on.
That's right. Children learn how to communicate with other adults by communicating with their parents. We have what we call the law of correspondence, which we teach in our adult courses, that says that your outer world is simply a mirror image of your inner world, that your outer world corresponds to your inner world, and that your outer world of relationships, especially with your children, with your spouse, simply corresponds to how you feel about yourself, how you're doing inside. And the wonderful thing is this, is that if you learn how to communicate more effectively with members of your family, you also find yourself getting along better with yourself, being a happier and more effective person inside.
I agree, Brian. I call this the car principle. I keep likening this to a car. You know, have you ever pulled up beside a car and noticed that the car was really dented or damaged, and you looked over and you went, ooh, let me just see if I can move across the parking lot? Why did you do that? Because you knew that the way that person cared for his car was the way he was going to treat your car, right?
That's right.
And communicating is like that, because the way we communicate with our children shows how we feel about ourselves. And the goal all the time is to continue to raise our children's sense of self, their self-confidence, their esteem level.
One of the other things we know about communicating is that it is a genuine physical and emotional and psychic need. In other words, just like we need food and water and air to be healthy physically, human beings need to be able to communicate effectively with others in order to be happy and to be fulfilled as a person. An individual, whether an adult or child, who finds it easy to express themselves and to communicate with others is a far happier person. An individual who is repressed or has difficulty expressing their thoughts and feelings is an unhappy person. And the wonderful thing about the family is that you can learn to be an excellent communicator within the laboratory of the family experience.
I agree. You know, Brian, earlier we talked about a philosophy in the family. And I think in communicating, we just have to keep going back to that philosophy about how important our children are to us. What are we trying to teach here? And this is really important because children, as they try to get their own needs met, oftentimes counterbalance our own style of communicating. I think back to young children, and even now when my teenager who wants to get things done all the time, and she'll come to me and she'll say, Mom, I just have to, and she'll tell me what she needs. She wants to stay overnight. She wants to have a friend come over. And the way she asks is so detrimental. It subtly sabotages what she's going to get. But what's really important for parents then is to listen to not only the content of what is being said, but to listen to the body language, and then to make a very important decision. And that is that if the child is in a very urgent state and obviously going to sabotage their relationship, to defer it. And here what you would do is, let's say, for example, Jennifer comes to me and she wants to go to a school event that's late in the evening, and one of our policies in our family is no school events in the middle of the week. And so I say no, or she knows she's going to get a no, and she wants to go so badly that the way she asks is just filled with anger and anticipation. What I might do then is, knowing that she's filled with anger, watching her body language, see how important it is to her, say to her, why don't we discuss this tonight at dinner? And that way, we remove the anger from it. And I get a chance to listen to the content, the body language, and then, of course, decide what I want to do about it.
Yes, I think that brings up a critical point of communicating, which is timing. There is a correct timing for every type of communication, and especially a communication that's charged with emotion. Sometimes one of the smartest things that you can do is delay the communication. Let's talk about this a little bit later. Let's talk about it at dinner. Let's talk about it tomorrow morning. In other words, let's not talk about it, but let's put off until it is a little bit more appropriate, till we're both a little bit less emotional and we can discuss it objectively.
Right, because one of the important ingredients in communicating is, and especially in helping your child feel valuable, is to follow through. I mean, when your child wants to communicate with you, you want to follow through on that. It's how your child learns to trust you.
One of the ways to diffuse the emotion in a communication, for instance, if your child says or does something that makes you feel angry or upset, or your child is angry or upset, is to try to remove the emotional component through questioning. And one of the things that we train adults to do, which is perfectly appropriate for parents, is to ask the six honest serving men of Rudyard Kipling, what exactly is it that you want to do? Why is it that you want to do this? When is it that you want to do it? How is it that you want to do it? Where is it that you want to do it? Who is it that you intend to do it with? By asking these questions, what and when and where and how and why and who, it causes the conversation to become more objective. It slows down the pace of conversation. It brings out more information. And as long as you are asking and answering these questions, you cannot simultaneously be emotional or upset. It has a tendency to diffuse the emotional component in any conversation, and it takes a tremendous amount of maturity on the parent to do this.
You know, Brian, an important part here is to look at why communicating is so important to children. And that is because children do believe that our show of affection, how we care about them, how we value them, how we love them even, is how we communicate. And one facet of that is the amount of time that we're willing to take with children when they are communicating to us.
A philosopher once said that all of life is the study of attention. All of life is the study of attention, and that you can tell who you are and what you are by where your attention goes. And we know that we always pay attention to what we most value. And children know that when we pay attention to them, when we listen to them, when we focus in on them, when they are expressing themselves to us, or when they're upset, or when they need to have that bond with us, that's the only way they know for sure that they're really important to us.
Right, Brian. I like the way you take the time with your three young children and just lay the newspaper down, for example, and listen to them.
Yes, and that takes us right into how do you communicate? What are some of the basic rules and techniques for an effective communication between two people, and especially between a parent and a child? That's probably the place to start.
Okay, and I think you call this all the time in the world syndrome, I think is
right.
An important place.
I think the first thing is always to listen attentively. When a child wants to communicate, our natural tendency is that if we are doing something else, we continue to do it, and we try to communicate at the same time. The danger is that if we do this, the child feels that you're continuing to wash the dishes or read the newspaper or get dressed or whatever it is you're doing is more important than the child. So what I trained myself to do from an early age is whenever one of my children wanted to communicate with me and I was reading, for instance, when they came, what I would do is I would take what I was reading and instead of just putting it aside, I would fold it up and put it aside. And I noticed a very interesting thing, is that this is a test for children, is they come and they want to see whether they're more important than what you're doing, whether they are more important than what you're reading, and they watch what you do with a piece of reading material, and in a way they measure how important they are by how willing you are to put down everything else when they need you.
And oftentimes, you know, they're very shocked. I mean, they're surprised that they are that important. And what they learn from that, Brian, is independence, rather than being very dependent. When they get a sense that you're important, that they're important to you, they're more self-assured. And very quickly, they turn and go back to their activities. But that's what they're looking for, is, am I important to you? Show me.
Yes, and I had a good friend who told me she was still in her 30s, and she was unmarried, and she was still unhappy about her childhood. And one of the things that she remembered more than anything else, her mother was a reader. And when she would go to her mother and she wanted her mother's attention, she wanted to talk to her, she wanted to hug her when she was a child, she still remembers her mother saying, "Go away, I'm reading. Get away from here, I'm reading. Don't bother me, can't you see I'm reading?" And that hurt her so much, even when she was 3 and 4 and 5, that when she was in her 30s, she still was suffering feelings of low self-esteem because she felt that her mother felt that the reading was more important than she was. And she told me this story before we had our first child, and I never forgot that. So whenever my children come and I'm reading, I remember that story that the parent affected their child's self-esteem for life.
I see this aspect of listening coming to play in some of the statistics on children who are dropping out, running away, the apathy, the behavior that we're seeing that's very detrimental to children. And if you think closely about children, and you know I work across the nation with parents with adolescent children, and when children are little, they say, "Watch me, Mommy. Watch me, Daddy." They want your time and attention. And teenagers want your time and attention, too. And they will get it one way or another. And communicating clearly with children, taking that time to show them important, is one way to keep our children on track.
And the difference between children and teenagers, younger children and teenagers, is younger children will do that. They'll say, "Daddy, Daddy, come here. Mommy, watch me. Look at me." And so on. They will express their need for your attention. Teenagers become more shy and more insecure in their maturity, and so they feel a little embarrassed about asking you to come and look at them. So instead, they'll say something like, "I've got a game at school on Saturday afternoon." And what they're really saying is they're not telling you their schedule. What they're saying is, "Would you come and watch me?" But they're a little bit shy about it, so they tend to do it more indirectly. And if you're not aware of that, sometimes you'll say, "Well, that's great. I don't have a good game." And you're not even aware of what was being communicated.
And what also happens, Brian, is that if we don't pay attention, if we don't catch those cues that our children are wanting our time and attention, what happens is that they become very angry. It turns to hostility. I'm thinking about a young boy that in Missoula, Montana, I was just up working with a group of juniors and seniors there, and the focus was self-esteem and building self-confidence and helping them feel capable and achievers. And I do an exercise with parents and teens to help them look at how well they communicate to one another. And so in this session, a young boy, his name was Chad. He said, "I'd like to send this message to my dad." And his dad was sitting right beside him. And he said, "Dad, as you know, I've been really angry in shop class." His father taught shop, and he happened to be in this class too. And he said, "Dad, I want you to know why." He said, "You touch all the other kids in the class." He said, "You put your hand on their shoulder." And he said, "You touch their hair and you tease them." And he said, "At nights in the garage, you putz around and you find things for them." He said, "Dad, you're always touching them." He said, "Dad, you don't do that for me." He said, "I've had 7 soccer games and you've not been there to one." And he said, "So the reason that I'm failing class and the reason I've been so angry, you know, is because I don't get your time and attention."
That brings up 2 really interesting points. One is that touch, physical communication, is a vital, vital part of communicating with a child. Children, as they grow older, are very reluctant to ask for it, but putting your arm around their shoulder, patting them on the back, holding their hand, and especially hugging them and expressing physical affection, even when they wrestle and they try to get away from you, is a wonderful way to communicate to them how important they are to you.
That's right. You know, Brian, in the next session, we're going to be talking about some creative ways to show children how we feel about them in terms of importance and raising their self-esteem and helping them feel capable because we communicate with them. And you're right, touching is very, very powerful. You know, teenage children, especially boys, accuse their fathers of stopping the touching and stopping communicating with them through touch in junior high. And I work with students throughout the nation, and they are very vocal about that.
We mentioned earlier that children have a tendency to react to their parents, and young children react very quickly. They push back if they feel that they are not being treated fairly or if they feel they're being deprived of their parents' love and attention. Teenage children will react also. They will push back. They will, as the example of Chad that you just gave, they will get even, and they'll get even by poor schoolwork. They'll get even by acting out. They'll get even by sometimes getting onto abusive substances. They will get even if they feel they're getting shortchanged in this communications part of the life.
You know, this brings us back to, Brian, how we show kids that we listen to them. And one area of that is listening very closely to what they need from us. I think about, again, my daughter in third grade who came home and said, "Mom, where did I come from?" And I went into a lecture 307 right away, you know, where the whole birth process. And later she went, "Oh, well, you know, Susie says she's from Philadelphia."
That's right. It's not listening. Now, one of the things that I find that I do with my children is I'll say, when they express something, I'll say, "Well, why do you feel that way? Or why did you say that?" Or even a better question is, "Well, how do you mean exactly?" The natural tendency that we as parents have is we want to give advice. They call this imposing your own experience on the child's experience. So the child says, "This happened to me," or "I'm having this problem." So we immediately go into the philosopher sage role and we say, "Well, perhaps you should do this," or "Why don't you do this?" and so on. When in many cases, the child doesn't want your advice at all. All they want is an opportunity to express themselves, to talk out their feelings, to talk out their situation, just to have you listen like a good friend would listen, and listen pretty much without commenting.
Right, Brian, we call this active listening. And what that really means is that the parent is listening so much to the content and the body language and for meaning that you're not just waiting for your turn to talk, that you're really listening. And then you're right. I mean, the questions are so key because later, if you say, when your child has just talked out, if you say to your child, "What should we do about this?" oftentimes they will then solve the problem and really feel like you have listened to them.
Or you can say, "Is there something that you want me to do? Is there something that I can help you with?" And sometimes they'll say, "No, I can take care of it myself." And you realize you didn't need to give advice at all. When you talk about empathic listening or reflecting back what the child is feeling rather than what they're saying, an example that happened in our house where Christina, after Michael was born, Christina would come in and say, "I hate my little brother." And my natural response initially was to say, "Oh, no, you don't. You love your little brother. You're just feeling cross today," and so on, until I realized that when she said, "I hate my brother," she was saying, "I have an emotional need. I feel hurt, or I feel threatened, or I feel unappreciated." So what I would do is I would reflect it back to her. I'd say, "You feel that we're paying too much attention to your little brother, don't you?" And she'd say, "Yes, I do." And you said, "You feel that we don't love you as much now that you have a little brother in the house, don't you?" And she said, "Yes, that's it." And we would say, "And you feel that we'll give more and more attention to this little brother and you'll no longer be the most important child in the family. Isn't that true?" And she said, "Yes." And she almost started to cry and she came and hugged me. And then we realized that what she was expressing in words was really an attempt to express her feelings. And only then do we respond by saying, "You're our number one child. We've loved you longer than anyone else. You're still our firstborn. You're still really, really important to us." And that was what she needed to hear. She didn't need to be talked out of the fact that she, quote, hated her little brother, end quote.
That's right. You know, Brian, your children are younger, and you've got the challenge of having those children be teenagers. My daughter's a teenager, and listening, as you know, is really important when your kids are little, and it becomes even more powerful when they're older. Just recently, my 15-year-old came home and said to me, "Mom, would you kick me out of the house if I were pregnant?" Now, immediately, when you think about that question, you could go into the whole idea of a child with birth control pills and the whole sexual agenda. And I listened more closely and asked her several other questions, and just to glean her out, to get her to talk about what was really on her mind, because I didn't know what was behind all of that message, but I wanted to find out before I went in and began, you know, talking. And I asked her several questions, and finally she said, "Well," she said, "Jana is pregnant, and her mother is kicking her out of the house." And I said, "Where is Jana going?" And she said, "Well, nowhere. She doesn't know where to go." And then I started talking about what I would do if that occurred to her. And I said, "Well, first of all, I would hold you very close, and we would wrestle out some very, very important questions. And then we would decide what to do with all of these important questions." And she said, "I know." You know, she just cut me off. She said, "I know. I just wanted to see how important I was to you."
What the child wants to know, literally all the time they're growing up, is, "Can I count on your love unconditionally? No matter what happens, will you still love me?" And children will ask it, as little children, they'll ask it, "Will you love me even if I do something awful?" When they're older, they ask it in more indirect ways. But the question always is, "Do you love me? Would you love me under any circumstances? Am I completely safe in your love.
Right. Do you love me unconditionally? Is this love without strings attached? And children do get that message from how we listen, from how we communicate with them, Brian. And it's more than anything else an esteem builder for them. It helps them feel capable and confident and self-assured. It helps them feel like they belong to a unit, like you're there for them, and with that, they can approach the world.
You know, much of the research on child development suggests that many problems that children have stem from the relationship they have with their father, even more than with their mother. And as a father, I realize that we tend to be more guilty of not listening than the children's mothers are, than our wives are. Women tend to be far better listeners for a variety of reasons, and it's men that, as much as anything else, need to practice this active listening. I think probably the best thing is when you come home at night, practice with your wife, is listen to her. Stop what you're doing. Turn off the television. Put down the newspaper. Stop doing anything that distracts you and focus in like you're trying to tune in to a distant station and listen attentively and without interrupting to your spouse, and then practice exactly the same technique on your children.
I agree, Brian. It's so important. You know, I think we probably have listeners who are saying, well, I do pretty well in communicating. If only I could do better with my parenting partner. You know, if only I could get my partner to have the same philosophy towards parenting or to listen more or whatever. And I keep bringing this idea back to parents, and that is that children's needs change throughout their stages of growth and development. And the skills that you need to show children attention and the way you communicate with children changes as they grow and change. And so a really important message here to parents is to not be afraid to gather the skills as their children grow. Don't feel you know it all. Take a look at communication styles that you might need. Feel free to stop into a course on communicating, or the schools now offer some really rich parenting programs. Participate in those and link up with other parents. What have they found that really works? What are the styles that are needed as their children grow and change?
Yes, and we talked about values. We talk about how you always express your values in your actions. It's absolutely amazing that probably less than 10% of parents have ever read a good book on parenting or taken a parenting course, and yet it's more important than any other single thing they do in life. It's more important than a career. It's more important than health. It's certainly more important than what is going on in sports, in the sports page. Just one course, one book, one little bit of information can give a parent insights into how to be more effective that they could not get in 20 years of stumbling around in the dark trying to figure it out by themselves.
Yes, you know, Brian, we were saying earlier that communicating is the common link in the parenting process. It just is one of the most important elements. And just as in a good marriage, communication, when it breaks down, changes the relationship completely. When communication is poor with your children, it changes the relationship completely. And one of the things that I'm always so aware of when working with parents throughout the nation is that many really regret the parenting they haven't done. They regret relationships, bonding relationships that are poor with their children. And so keeping that communication open, finding ways to reach children, finding ways to talk with children, finding ways to get your child to talk with you is a real important link to your overall sense of self-esteem, to your overall sense of self. Really another way to increase your joy in parenting, because parenthood is hard work. But you ought to find ways to increase the joy, and communicating is a real link here.
I was down in the deep south in Georgia not long ago, and a friend of mine was telling me about a father, a friend of his, who has three teenage boys in their late teens. And he was saying, you know, I never had a lick of trouble with them boys. And he was saying, that's true. These boys are so good. They're strong. They're positive. They have a wonderful relationship with their parents. They do well in school. They don't drink. They come home on time. And the father said, I never had a lick of trouble with my boys. And this friend of mine responded, he has children too, he said, then I'll bet one thing. I'll bet that you spend a lot of one-on-one time with each of those boys every week. And the father said, you know, he said, that's true. He said, I spend at least 2 hours per week with each child, just one-on-one, talking and listening. He said, we sit out in a swing on the front porch, and sometimes we'll sit there for the whole evening, and we'll just talk, and I'll just listen to what he's saying. And he said, I come to the conclusion from what you say that spending at least 2 hours a week with your children will head off more problems than probably any other act that you as a parent can take. Is that if you've got that open channel of communication and you take the time to keep that channel open all the time, most of the problems that children get into won't arise. And if they arise, they'll be nipped in the bud.
Right. You know, Brian, when I wrote the book, Helping Your Teenager, A Parent Survival Guide, one thing that came through clear over and over and over in the research was that children are wanting time and attention, and how much time we spend with them is a serious part of how much our children will stay connected to us and not turn for peer approval to others for outside reassurance. And the hallmark of that is that children's first influence point is the parent. They want our time and attention before anyone else. And if it's there, that relationship is there, and children are generally safeguarded. If it's not there, children turn to other sources to get approval.
Well, that's really just saying that children have needs, and if the needs are fulfilled at home, then they don't need to go outside. It's almost like vitamins and minerals. If a child is getting a thoroughly nutritious diet at home, they don't need to go out and get food somewhere else. If a child is getting their emotional needs met at home, they're far less susceptible to seeking for the approval of their peers in order to get their emotional needs met outside.
That's really true, Brian. And I think in this next session, we're going to be talking about some of the creative ways to do that, because you and I know, as busy parents and as career people, that a real challenge to parents today is to find the time, not just the quality time, but the quantity of time that's needed to spend with children.
Maybe we could recap some of the key points in this session. I think the first one, and the starting point of being a really good communicator, is to make a decision that ongoing, warm, effective communications with your child is a top priority in your life. That's a decision that you have to make before anything else.
That's right. And a second would be to look for ways to communicate with your child that shows your undivided time and attention.
And a third is to realize that communicating is a core skill of parenting, that it's not something you do when it comes up. It's something that you plan for, that you organize for, and that you realize this is my job. This is not a distraction from something else. This is the core job. So that takes us to the skill of listening attentively. When your child wants to talk, listen without interruption. Listen patiently. Listen as though you have all the time in the world. Stop everything else you're doing and just relax and focus in on the child.
Right. And another would be to remember a style that works, and that is to first of all be listening for content, and secondly be observing the body language that's going on. And then the third aspect of that is to feel free to defer. If there's too much anger and you're going to get baited in and you know nothing is going to be resolved that's going to be a positive outcome in building the child's self-esteem and his self-confidence, defer it to a time when something constructive can occur.
We also say to question for clarification by asking questions like, well, honey, how do you mean that? Or what do you mean when you say that? Or why do you feel that way? Or why are you saying it in that way? Can you help me to understand?
And I think another area, Brian, is to be a little selfish here, to realize that the core of communicating well with your children lends to a real satisfying bonding with your child, one that makes you feel pretty good about yourself, too. And I know that for me, when I drop my child off at school, and I feel we've had just a 5 to 8 minute drive that's been open and warm and we're really on the same wavelength, my day is different.
If you can resist the impulse to give advice. And the way you resist the impulse is whenever you feel that you should now impose your experience or your knowledge and wisdom on the situation, ask the child, what would you like to do? Or what do you think we should do in this situation? Or what are you going to do now? Or is there any way that I can help you? And very often your children, through that action, will be encouraged to think independently and to make independent decisions, which are very often pretty good.
Yes, and to come back to a question that's very central to how you communicate, and that is to say, what is my goal here? What do I want to teach my child by my response to what he's wanting right now? What is my goal here? I keep thinking about Lily. Lily was a woman I worked with, a parent in New York, and she had six-year-old twins, Brian, and six-year-old twins are really learning how to wrestle things out. And she said, I would get baited into this, and my sons would be calling out saying, Mom, come solve this. And she said, on the way to the room, I would just be livid, and I would go in there and I would clean house. And she said, then all three of us would be really angry and disappointed. And she said, so I decided that my goal here was to teach these children a model for communicating, and they were learning my model, and it wasn't an effective one. She says, so I put up a sign on the door that said, goal. You want to teach these children how to communicate, how to solve their own problems. And she said, I'd come running to that room to solve their problems, and I would see that sign. And she said, it allowed me to communicate in a way that stayed consistent with my value to teach my children that how I solve their problem was also teaching them a style.
In my family, I call it reasonableness. I think one of the most important parts of your relationship with your children is for your children to perceive you as being reasonable, as opposed to being unreasonable. And so I often start my communication, especially when I'm correcting my children for some reason, I start by saying, I am a very reasonable person. So let's talk this out and let's make a decision. And now my children come back to me and they say, Daddy, you're a very reasonable person, aren't you? And they use it on me. But what I've trained them to think in terms of is that conversations and problem resolution should be based on a reasonable basis rather than an emotional or an angry or a hostile basis.
Yes, and see, what you're really doing here is you're teaching them again a style, because they have learned this style from you and they're saying, well, that was pretty effective. Let me just try this one back. And that's exactly what we're trying to do here. We're trying to teach our children a model, a style of communicating that works for them in a way that allows them to solve problems, generate alternatives, get results that are positive. And that's the overall goal of communicating.
Yeah, and I would think the final recommendation I would make to parents who want to communicate effectively is to practice what we call feedback, is to paraphrase what the child has said in your own words by saying, well, let me see if I've got this straight. What you're saying is this, or the reason you feel this way, or the reason you're upset or angry is this, and feed it back in your own words so that the child can say, yes, that's why I'm upset or angry. Also, turn it around, and when you are giving instructions or you're giving feedback to your children, have them feed it back to you. Because, for instance, sometimes we'll have a little conflict with our children and we'll resolve it, and then I'll say to my child, now, what have you learned? What have you learned? And they're very quick to pick up, well, I've learned that I should pick up the glass with both hands. I've learned that I should do my homework when I get home at night rather than letting it build up so I don't have time to do it. I've learned that I should always tell the truth. So if you have them feed back to you what they've learned as a result of the communication, it's amazing how much they get out of it and how much they grow as people.
Session 6, Creating Opportunities for Connecting with Your Child. Children need and want your time and attention. In this exciting session, Brian and Betty share creative techniques for enhancing special bonding time with your child.
We said at the beginning that the role of parenting is to nurture your children and raise them with high self-esteem. That if they have high levels of self-esteem, that will translate into happiness, self-confidence, and a willingness and an ability to take on the world. And we also said in the last session that the key to high self-esteem, the key to a child's feeling really, truly valuable, is ongoing communication with their parents, with having lots of time and attention and extended periods where they can get together with their parents and just talk and communicate and relate and just be there. So an important part of parenting is to create those opportunities for contact and communication.
Yes, and perhaps it's even more difficult in today's time where we have more distractions on children's time. Television, for example, takes away a lot of time from children's togetherness with parents. We now know that one out of every two parents are single, so that they're spending lots of time in their workplace and away from children. So a real challenge today, Brian, is to find creative ways to connect with your children in a way that allow him to get his needs met for not only parent bonding, but for increasing his own sense of self-esteem and capability in taking on the world, as we call it.
Well, the way I look at it is if you wanted to be physically fit, you would have to schedule 30, 60 minutes at the gym or in some kind of physical exercise two or three times a week. If you want to be properly fed, you have to schedule time to eat. If you want to be properly rested, you have to schedule time to rest. Everything depends upon how important you consider it to be. So the starting point is to set a goal. If one of your most important values is raising happy, healthy, self-confident children, then you start off by setting targets and scheduling specific periods and activities throughout the week, throughout the month, and throughout the year where you and your children will go away and do things together.
I think that's a good place to start, Brian, by talking about some of the creative ways that that can be done in today's times when parents are busy and there are distractions on children's time.
One of the things that we have found that is very, very easy and has been just wonderful for our family is family walks. Is we make an arrangement that I and or my wife will be home by 6 o'clock, maybe even by 5:30, and that before we have dinner, we will all go for a walk. And we've been doing this since even before our first child was born. When our first child was born, we took her along in a backpack until she could walk, and then she walked. The second child came along, and we put the second child in the backpack, and the two of us went. Now what we do is we have three children. They all walk, and we all go for family walks, and we try to do it every night. We don't make it, but we aim to go for a family walk for 30 to 60 minutes every night. And we get more bonding, more communication, more fun, more laughter, more opportunity for Barbara and I to talk, more opportunity for the children to explore and to come back and relate with us and run ahead and come back. I would think that if a family just did nothing but that every single day, just go for a walk at the end of the day, that alone would be a tremendous experience.
I think a good place to start also is for parents to evaluate the amount of time that they currently spend with their children. You know, there's been a lot of, is it quality time? Is it quantity time? And all of the research, Brian, shows that it is both. It is quality and it is quantity time. That quiet, silent time that you and your child spend alone is also a very, very important time. But I ask parents to start by evaluating how much time do they spend with their children, and just to get a sense of what that is.
I think many parents have been misled into thinking that you can say, all right, now I'm going to have 30 minutes of quality time. And my experience is that quality time is a function of quantity of time, in that the quality moments, the moments of fun, the moments of warmth, the moments of happiness come unbidden. They come not as a result of scheduling them or planning for them, but simply of creating enough time so that they occur in their own time. They occur unbidden and unplanned for. And so you have to have quantities of time if you're ever going to have quality time.
Right. You know, Brian, one positive outcome of that, too, is that we learn a lot about our children in those quiet moments when they feel free to talk about things that are bothering them. When I wrote the book Stress in Children that looked at the effects of contemporary society on children, we looked at the fears that children had that we as adults were quite surprised by. And so one very important part is to find out how are children faring? What is important in their lives? What's going on in there that we don't know about? And one of the things that I found to be very effective over the years in parenting my daughter with regard to this, to learning about her, the her that I didn't know, was to, at some point, you know how children love to window shop, just to take a stroll in the evening or on a weekend, sometime when the stores are closed, and throw your arm around your child and just go walking and be silent. Feel free to accept that silence. And your child will rattle on and on and on about things that might very well be surprising to you.
That's when the very best communication takes place, is when there is, if you like, a mild distraction going on at the same time.
Absolutely.
Going for a walk, going window shopping, going grocery shopping. One of the things that I do with my children that's become a family ritual is I try to take them everywhere. I never get in the car to go to the office to pick up something or to run an errand or to drop something off without saying, does anybody want to come with me? And now my children naturally assume that if I'm going out the door, they're entitled to come. And I always encourage that. So I went swimming yesterday, and I just went over for half an hour to a nearby pool. And I said, well, I'm going swimming. Who wants to come? And literally in 30 seconds, all three of them were in the car, strapped in, waiting to go, because they naturally assume that's part of their position, is that they go with their daddy. And we have wonderful moments like that. We talk about what's going on at school, and we resolve conflicts. So we take every single chance to get quantity of time, and the quality of time comes along.
It's true. You know, I was a university professor for many years and taught at a campus that was 2 hours away from the main campus. And I went there once a week to teach a course. And it used to be my favorite time, and no one else wanted to do it because it was 2 hours of driving down and 2 hours of driving back. And I used to enjoy it and look forward to it so much because my daughter, who was younger then, would come with me. And those 2 hours of time, Brian, were so treasured. We learned to love one another so much by those hours that, you know, you couldn't go any other place. You were there. You were there together. And it was a lot of quality and quantity time. As you tell this story about your children and they're younger, and you have this to look forward to, and your kids are teens. My daughter informed me this morning on the way to school that it was just a few months away from her 16th birthday. And, you know, I was to know what that meant because she was now going to be driving. And it dawned on me as I was coming here this morning, Brian, that I'm going to lose that time with her, and I'm going to miss it greatly. That 5 to 8 minutes of time that I take her to school in the morning is a very important connection time, and I'm going to miss that.
I heard a father once tell a story of what happened when he was a child, and he passed it on to his children. He said that he was about 11 years old, and his father was working very hard, and they didn't have very much money. And when his birthday came, the only thing he got for his birthday was a card in an envelope, and it was given to him. His father said, "I don't have a lot to give you, but this is your birthday present," and he gave him the card. He said, "I was really disappointed," he said, "but I opened the card and I read it, and inside the card, my father had written, 'I owe you 1 hour per day for as long as you want it.'" And it was signed by his father. And what his father had committed to was that every single day he would spend at least one solid hour with his boy. And this man was now a father, and he looked back over the decades, and he said it was the most wonderful treasure that he ever received from his father, because his father absolutely kept his word, is that every single day he came home and made an hour for his son. He said it was the richest single experience of his childhood was the hour every day that he spent with his father.
This is why I think it's so important that when you are in the car with your child, you turn the radio off. So often it's convenient just to turn on tunes. And I think it's very important to turn that radio off and just to know that that is a together time. Because what we're really talking about here is how parents can find the time, make the time, take the time that is so often, you know, just not there in crowded and busy lives.
And at home, turn off the television.
Absolutely.
Now, many parents are getting to the point where they want to throw the television away. But what we have found is that you don't throw it away. What you do is you just delay turning it on in the evening. If you have dinner, say, at a specific time, say between 6 and 7, turn off the television during dinner. Never, never watch the television during a meal. And then just say, we're not going to turn on the television until 8 or 8:30 or 9 o'clock. And you'll find that you create this wonderful vacuum in the home that when there's no television to fill it, it's automatically filled with communication and interaction and games and play and banter and running around. In other words, when you create the vacuum, it's automatically filled with family activities.
It is. Well, Brian, most parents today, and I am a strong advocate of it, are simply turning off the television during the weeknights. When we look at children's lives, you know, we diagnose a lot of ulcers in children, and when we look at what's going on in their lives to create such great disturbance, many children's lives are very, very busy, if not physically busy from all of their activities. They're emotionally involved in a lot of things. And one of the things that children say is they do not have enough time for themselves. Well, many adults feel that they don't have enough time for themselves. By turning off the television, you create some empty time, some time that just seems like it's yours. It's a corner for yourself. And it helps children feel like they have some time back. It also greatly correlates with children who are creative. Television, you know, is the one aspect where you don't need skills to watch television.
That's
and
right.
You're no better off when you finish watching television. You have not gained any skills. And so it provides a time for children to be creative, to get into their own creativity.
And something else you can do is when you turn off the television, turn on a classical music station on the radio. There's lots of studies that show that playing classical music in the background not only is very relaxing emotionally and psychologically, but it tends to enhance creativity. If your children are studying or reading, it tends to enhance their ability to learn and to remember. It tends to lower the emotional or the frictional tone throughout the house. It gives sort of a gentle background of classical music. And that's a really good thing to do as an alternative to the television because it also stimulates conversation, it stimulates interaction, it stimulates communication. It stimulates warmth and exchange.
Right. And Brian, a real key here is that communicating and creating ways to communicate with children opens our accessibility to them. I travel a lot, and I know you do too. One of the things that I have found to be very important is to always allow my family to have access to me, and most especially my daughter. I leave a phone number for her, and while she rarely calls me when I'm traveling, she knows that it's a direct line to Mom. And that's true at my place of work, too. When my daughter calls, I'm there for her.
I travel a lot, and I've made a habit, even when I've traveled to places like Europe and Australia, I've made a habit to almost every night to phone back and speak to Barbara, my wife, and to each of my children, if only for a few seconds, and always start off by saying, how was your day? And I always end up by saying, I love you. So that when I'm away, they suffer very little sense of deprivation. Of course, Barbara takes wonderful care of them, but the fact is they know that their father will be communicating, and they line up on the telephone.
Right. What it is an open line to you.
Yes. I had a funny incident recently where I called up and I was speaking to Barbara, and I said, let me speak to Christina. And Barbara said, Christina, Daddy's on the phone. And she replied, I could hear her in the background, she said, tell him I love him too, and I'll talk to him next time.
She's used to that communication. She was counting on it. I think another important part here is to schedule our vacations and our work.
Our lives are so busy today that if we just allow family time to evolve when we have the time, it very often doesn't. So what I started doing a few years ago, and I find many, many parents are doing this now, is they'll sit down on January 1st and they will plan their family time for the rest of the year. They will plan their long weekends. They'll plan their summer vacations. They will plan their trips. They'll plan their Christmas vacations. And they will block those out exactly as though they were business appointments. And then they will force the rest of their business life to conform to those. And when you make that decision, the most remarkable thing happens. First of all, the rest of your work life does conform to your schedule. Second of all, you say very, very clearly that my family activities, my family schedules are my highest value. And you can only do this by blocking the time off and making that time inviolable. Now, again, my wife is very helpful in this because my natural tendency is if a business opportunity comes up, I will say, well, can I fudge on this period? Can I take this one day out? And she will say, absolutely not. And so she's broken me of the habit of it. And now my children know months in advance that they're going to be having a week off here or 4 weeks there or 3 days here. And it really helps our family.
One of the things that I do to show my daughter that I have time and attention for her is to make room throughout my week to have time for her when she can kind of show off, so to speak. You know, children, we were saying earlier, always want our time and attention, and how much time we give them is a clear indication of how much we value them. And my daughter is a tremendous athlete, and as such, I can't always, with my traveling schedule, I can't always make her games, or I can't always be there when she has a city tournament. And so what I often do is I'll walk up to her school and just sit on the bleachers. There I am, you know, a sole parent watching this tedious practice, and I'll look over and my daughter will see me and her eyes will spark up and all of a sudden this incredible energy comes into her and she'll perform, you know, really well. But what she does is she gets an idea that I'm important to my mother and that it's just that way of connecting. And, you know, she's not a star at that particular time. It's just that connection time. So I think we have to look for ways to be with our children, not so much when they're just a star, when they're, you know, showing off, but a time when we just say, I'm here for you.
I read a wonderful story of a man who went one weekend with his son fishing, and they spent almost the whole day fishing in the weekend, and they had very little conversation. And he went home that night and he felt very disappointed. He felt that the weekend had been a failure because very little had transpired. They had not said very much to each other. The time had just seemed to have drifted by. And he wrote that down in his journal, that he really felt disappointed in the time that he'd spent with his son because he'd hoped for more of it. Many years later, his son came across his father's journals and read it. And he went back and he read his journals. And the son had written in his journals that this was one of the most beautiful days that he'd ever spent with his father because they'd spent the whole day together without saying very much. And so the father had thought that the fishing trip was a failure, but for the son it was one of the most precious moments and best memories of his youth simply because they were being there together. that nothing needed to happen, no great communications, no great breakthroughs, no clouds parting or anything else, just the very fact of the two people being together for an extended period of time was translated as one of the richest moments of a boy's life.
You know, bringing up this idea of memories is very powerful. One of the things we do to help children get a sense of their belonging to us is to tell them stories. I do this a lot with Jennifer, and sometimes I'm prodded by her. She'll say to me, "Mom, tell me about the time I was 7, or tell me that story that you told Susan when." And so an important part is saying, "You were so cute when you were 7, you," and then go into the story. And what you're doing for children is you're reconnecting time and space for them. And again, it brings back to them their importance to us.
Yes, and one of the most important parts of any group of people, they say that a nation is a group of people with a background of shared experiences. And we know that a family is bonded together by shared experiences, either shared joys or shared laughter or shared tragedies. Let me give you a little example. Not long ago, my little boy David swallowed a penny, and I had been doing magic tricks where I'd pretended that I'd put a quarter in my mouth and then I pulled it out of his ear. So he took and he swallowed a penny when the babysitter was there and went to the babysitter and said, "I swallowed the penny, take it out of my ear." And the babysitter just had a bird and called my wife, who came running home, and they took David to the hospital and they did x-rays, and the penny was stuck in the esophagus, so they put him under a general anesthetic so they could reach down and pull it out, but the general anesthetic relaxed the pipe and it dropped into his stomach, so now it had to work its way through the system. They had to go to 2 or 3 hospitals and more x-rays, and because there's a possibility it could perforate. And so this went on for about 2 days before it was finally realized that the only way the penny would come out is if it passed through. So every single day we would take David to the toilet and go through his stools to find the penny. Finally, on the 5th day, the penny passed. The situation was over. It ended. And we gave David the nickname of David the Penny Pooper. And everybody in the family laughs about David the Penny Pooper, including little David, 3 years old, the Penny Pooper. He walks around as if he has got a badge of honor from combat. His name is David the Penny Pooper, and everybody in the family laughs. This is the sort of shared experience that bonds a family together. And, of course, it's an unbidden experience because you can't predict it or plan for it in advance.
I think what you're really saying here is that families that play together, stay together kind of idea. And I think it's an important point because finding the time to play together, when we play with our children, not only is it fun and is it bonding, it's a wonderful way to communicate. And children get messages from that. They get messages that they're important and that they're fun. Another powerful way to communicate with children, Brian, is through children's friends. This is important as children get older. And a key link here is inviting other friends to your home, because children get a chance to see you from another child's light, and that's very important. Just recently, one of Jennifer's friends said to Jennifer, "Your mother is so funny." And Jennifer backed up and looked, and she said, "I don't think of my mother as funny." And Jennifer, you know, then questioned her, "Why do you think?" "Well, I think your mother is." And that's an important part of communicating when children see us through their friend's eyes. You know, they say that we can see how well our children are adjusted by the numbers and how often children bring friends to our home. And I think it's important that parents look at that dimension of our children's friends in how well we are doing in communicating.
Well, there's another aspect of this, too, and parents today want to be successful. Parents today have goals and they have ambitions. They want to achieve financially. They want to move ahead in their careers. We're all the same. And I get the question over and over again in my seminars is, if it's so necessary to work hard in a competitive society to be successful, how do you find time for your family? How do you manage to achieve balance? If you want to fulfill your responsibilities to your children and you want to be successful at your career, how do you do it? Now, there may be many ways to do it, but my approach is very simple. What I do is I divide my life basically into two parts, my work life and my home life. And when I'm not working, I'm at home with my family and my young children. And when I'm not with my family and my children, I'm working. But I don't go bowling and fishing and hunting, and I don't belong to clubs and organizations and associations, and I don't take a series of other trips and engage in a lot of other activities. I would love to do all those things, but the only way that I can work hard enough to achieve my goals in my career and be a good parent is if I do only those two things. Now, the wonderful thing is this, is my children understand that. And although my children are very demanding and we have a tremendous relationship, they know that if Daddy's not here, he's working, and if he's not working, he's here. So they don't suffer any deprivation. They don't feel like they're competing with me for something else. They know that Daddy does his work, which is important to our home and our life and their clothes and school, and when Daddy's not working, he's with us. So one of the best ways to achieve balance is to start to make some very, very hard choices. And especially when your children are young, that's the time that you have to make the sacrifices in terms of sorting out all other extracurricular activities that are less important than your children's emotional health.
Well, I think what we find is that over our children's stages of growth and development, our ability to balance our lives more in other areas do change. When my daughter was smaller, I had to take on that work and or home concept. As my daughter got older and I wanted to integrate more of my social life, my own fitness, I found ways to do more of that with my family. And I find now that as my daughter is now a teenager, now I'm able to go back and pick up and develop other interests that I've not had a chance to do. And so I think it changes over the life cycle of children. I think that juggling and balancing are two important words. Many parents feel like they're juggling as opposed to looking for creative ways to balance all of our needs in our life.
Yes. One of the things that I try to do is whenever possible, I'll take my children on a business trip. It may be a little bit more expensive and it may be a little bit more inconvenient, but it gives us wonderful time to communicate, and it also helps the child understand how the world works. Because I tell my child, whether it's Christina or Michael, they're the two that are old enough to do it, why we're going on this trip, what we hope to accomplish, who our clients are, what the work is. And whenever possible, I get them involved in the work. I get them involved in helping and doing little things. And they feel tremendous about it. They go to school at show and tell. They explain they went on a business trip, and this is what their daddy does for work, and this is the work that they did. And sometimes I'll pay them $1 or $2 or $5 for working, so they feel they were on a working business trip themselves. And again, it's just a way to develop and build those structured activities and opportunities for quality time with your children.
Right, and also since our world of work is such a powerful and important part of our lives as adults, it also opens up a way for us to build our children's not only sense of work life, but their own sense of self-esteem. I travel with my daughter now and then, too, and she gets a chance to see me outside of my role as a parent, which is another form of communicating. You know, it's another way of looking at another aspect of me that she doesn't see in the home place. And I think the message to parents here is to take children, at least to your workplace. I work with children who have never been to their parents' workplace. Many children in the nation, Brian, can't tell you what their parents do for work, nor have they been to their parents' workplace. And for young children, this creates fears. I mean, they don't know what you do, and it's the unknown that creates some fears for them, because at some stages, fearing for their parents' well-being is an important part of their psychological needs.
Well, an important point is that we have a tendency to raise our children the way we were raised, and we have a tendency as adults to incorporate into our life the values that our parents had. If our parents came from a traditional upbringing where the wife and the children stayed at home, the father went to work, the two were completely separate. I heard a woman say recently, "I don't care what my husband does, he makes the living and I don't want to hear about it." Well, if we come from an upbringing like that, we may have a tendency to superimpose that value structure on our family, even though that's not what we want. We may think that it's in the normal course of things. We do not tell our children or our family what we do. That's the man's role or that's the woman's role. And yet what you have to do is you have to stand back and say, what's important to me? What's really important to me? Do I want my children involved in my work? Do I want to spend a lot of time with my children? Is creating opportunities to spend time with them a vital part of my goals for my family? And then you have to question your own upbringing and say, what parts of my upbringing were less satisfactory than I would desire? What parts of my own upbringing were perhaps not consistent with what I want to achieve with my family? And questioning your own upbringing is the starting point of defining yourself and your family on your own terms.
Right. You know, I hear so many parents say children are to be seen and not heard. And that approach didn't work very well for this generation, and it doesn't work very well for our children. So thinking about our philosophy of children's role in our life. Thinking about what we want for our children and how we communicate that is an important part. I know one of the things that's important to all children is to feel like they are a significant part of their parents' life. It not only contributes, again, to the esteem, but their overall sense of feeling capable and confident in the world. And sometimes what I do with my daughters, if I'm talking with adults and Jennifer will come into the picture, I can't just stop and talk with her, but I'll put my arm around her and just draw her to me and continue talking. So I think we have to look for ways to show children that we're connected to them, even as we go about our busy lives.
And one final point which I would mention is when I was growing up, my parents believed that the children never dined with the adults, that the children always dined separately. They ate in the kitchen. They ate somewhere else, but adults ate separately. When my parents had visitors over, the children were always sent to their bedroom. The children and the adults never met. What I have found with my children, and I made this decision very early, is that I incorporate them into all adult activities, or almost all adult activities, where they sit at the table, they interact with our guests, they go for dinners with us, not always, but often enough so that they get an opportunity to be treated like adults. They get an opportunity to feel that they are fully functioning members of this family as opposed to second-class members. And we are constantly getting comments on how mature our children are, how together they are, how well-behaved they are with other adults. And the people who are saying this, of course, are parents who have not done this with their children. They've been raised in the old school that children are to be seen and not heard.
We've been talking a lot about some of the skills for communicating. And one of the things that I think we haven't mentioned are some of the subtle ways that children also see their importance to us, and not just because we're talking or demonstrating it in touch. I think back to two things that my mother did when and there were six children in our family, and she did this in spite of the fact there were six of us. I think back to two things that have left a very powerful impression on me. The first is she would hand us children the mail if it was in our name. And of course, children don't get lots of mail, but if the mail came in our names, she didn't open it first and then give it to us. She gave it to us and then wouldn't peer over our shoulders, knowing that at some point we'd probably come back and have to have it read to us. But she'd give us that mail, and what she was saying to us is, you're important, this is your mail. She did not open that mail. And the second thing she did was she would periodically set the table with the best china just for children, and I didn't understand the implications of that until one day my aunt was visiting. And she came in and looked, and she said, oh, I see you're expecting company. And my mother said, no. And she said, well, why is the good china out? And my mother said, I've prepared my children's favorite meal. If you prepare a good meal for visitors and then you set your good china for company, why wouldn't you do that for your children? And I felt pretty important. I felt pretty connected. And I've never forgotten those expressions. And what they are ways to communicate with our children that we're pretty powerful.
And maybe one more thing we could say to wrap this session up is the way you treat your children in front of other people when you're engaged in family activities is terribly important to them. If you respect them, if you speak to them deferentially, if you ask for their opinion, especially when they have children over, when they have their friends over, if you talk to them as though they're mature, you ask for their advice or their opinion, you greet them with respect in front of their friends, it makes them feel really terrific. And when you're traveling, if you introduce them to people as your child and say something positive about them, this is my little girl, Christina. She is just the most helpful little girl that you can imagine. Or this is David. He is really radical. Or you just introduce your children and say something about them that's important. Or in restaurants, treat them as though they're adults that you're out dining with and talk to the waiter or the waitress or have them talk to the waiter or the waitress just the way adults do. Just the way you treat them in front of other people when you're engaged in these family activities can put as much value into the family activities as anything else you can do.
Right, and be very consistent. A 14-year-old boy said to me recently, my father was yelling at me, and then the phone rang, and he turned and talked to the guy on the phone, and he was in such a good mood, and then he hung up the phone and turned back to me and began yelling again. And what he was saying was, he was not respectful to me. He was respectful on the phone, and he saw right through that. Children have long antenna, so keep a consistency in what children are learning.
Yeah, the aim of parenting, the role of parenting, is to raise children with high self-esteem. And spending time with them in structured activities and treating them as though they're really important during those activities is one of the finest ways to make them feel terrific about themselves.